Well, yes, so this morning's subject, right concentration, and this brings us into the higher reaches of something we've been studying over the past few weeks, actually, which is the Eightfold Path. Now, don't worry for you guys that you've missed all these. All of these steps can be taken and thought about individually, but they do also kind of talk to each other as well. The Eightfold Path is not seen as a rigid set of steps that you must follow. It's all the elements of the Eightfold Path support each other. And we really start to see that with this subject, right concentration, actually. We've actually touched the beginnings of right concentration over the last couple of weeks, as we looked at right effort and right mindfulness. Although personally I'm a way off experiencing the higher levels of right concentration, a little of my personal experience I can build into this talk, and then for the higher levels I'm going to touch on them, but I'll be just covering what I've read and what I've been taught. I haven't yet experienced. Maybe one day I will. Who knows? But so we've said it's the higher reaches of the path, but we don't view it as the culmination of the path. Actually, in many ways, the culmination is right where we started, with right view. The actual view we establish at the start may be different to the view we have towards the end, because during the journey, our view on life and our spiritual path and where we're headed may well change, because it gets influenced by our practice. But it is a right view that we end up with. Little context first. So right concentration. We're going to head back to our analogy of a journey, because it's kind of appropriate with an Eightfold Path. And of course, when we're out on a journey, we need some signposts. When we're driving around, we get a great deal of help from signposts. And some of those signs are very detailed. Turn left in 200 yards for the Sangha House, for example. There's a signpost. We need that one out there. We should put that up. Often you see more generalised signposts. So the north is one you quite often see on the motorway. The advice we get from right concentration in terms of, and when I say advice here, I'm talking about the advice that the Buddha gave us, that's presented in the Pali Canon. And in many ways, the advice to do with right concentration can be seen on the same generalised level. It's not an exact science, this. It's head north. In truth, nothing is ever exact in Buddhist practice, because we are all so very different. Our minds, individually, infinitely complex. So our journey along a spiritual path is always going to be very, very individual. In our analogy with the journey to get to Scotland from Taunton, there's loads of options. You know, we could head via Wales, for example. But one definite piece of advice still exists: head north. And the advice in right concentration is a little like this. So many approaches to developing our concentration, and there are some milestones which apply to us, all of us, despite our individualistic nature. And of course, we pass those milestones on our journey. Before we delve into this, though, let's look at this phrase, right concentration, because if there's a right concentration, it implies there's a wrong concentration. What might that be? At a broad level, we all intuitively know what right concentration is. It's focused and not distracted. It's able to keep attention to the chosen subject. And that in itself takes practice. But remember that the practice of Buddhism trains the mind to be focused, free from the hindrances, and we'll talk about those. It trains us to be wholesome, compassionate and tranquil. So right concentration also carries all of these elements, all aspects of the Eightfold Path that we've been exploring so far. They all come into play here. So as an example, a sniper has a very concentrated mind. They must be able to take aim and hit their target under extreme conditions. It's a real honed skill and extremely difficult, but not compassionate. The intent sitting behind the action will result in an unwholesome mind state. The karma vipaka, the result of the action, will sit with the soldier for the rest of their life. And we must remember the purpose of the Eightfold Path is to move towards the cessation of suffering in ourselves and others. That must be built into right view, so the action of the sniper is clearly off that path. Clear and calm as their concentration may be, it's not part of the Eightfold Path. So in our explanation of right concentration, we should look at it and keep the right view in mind. Is our practice, that may well be developing a calm, concentrated mind, also going to develop a mind that's wholesome, compassionate, and carries with it an equanimity of love for all beings? Whew. Love for all beings. Okay. Not broad beans, no. All beans. That's a good bit for the tape. Excellent. Oh dear. So let's come back to these milestones. Hi, Natalie. Don't worry. So the milestones. Okay, so we're going to introduce something here that's part of concentration. And these are called the jhanas. Okay? Anyone heard of the jhanas? One. Okay. You heard of the jhanas, Natalie?
I have. Yeah.
So there are 8 jhanas or jhanic states. And essentially, these are states of deep mental unification. And they are accessible with practice to all of us. The idea of a signpost is a really good analogy here. As we progress on our journey, we don't deliberately think about the signposts when we get in our car. As we progress, we don't think, I'm on the M5 now, and in 30 miles I will see another signpost and it will say Birmingham so many miles. We don't work that way. We come upon the milestones and they're useful and helpful when they happen. They confirm that we're heading in the right direction and we use them to help and guide us. But they aren't the sole aspect of our journey, and that is a key thing. So our purpose is not to collect milestones. It is to arrive at the destination. And the jhanas in this way are very similar. We come across them in our experience of meditation. And when they arise, we notice them and we say, ah, good, I'm heading in the right direction. We can listen to them and feel what they teach us and then come back to the practice. Okay, and that is an important point because they can become very seductive, the jhanas, and we can develop a sense of pride for the fact that we've reached a particular jhanic state. And yes, as you can see, they're not to be collected. They rise out of the right conditions. We won't see a sign for Birmingham if we've turned southwest and we're heading for Cornwall. The jhanas arise because of appropriate and right moral, ethical, mental preparations and conditions. And of course, this is actually why the Buddha set out the Eightfold Path. Because by following the path, we develop the right conditions and the jhanas will emerge. When the conditions are right, the jhanas arise. And one of the primary conditions is the removal of a set of five mental objects. These are mind experiences that we know as the five hindrances. And these are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. So these five are the things that stop us from making progress with our meditation and developing right concentration. When these are fully and completely removed, the jhanas materialize. The practice of meditation and mindfulness is our vehicle for removing these hindrances in our lives. And the jhanas themselves, when we experience them, they help us to further remove them and to embed essentially a mental habit for letting go of the five hindrances. So far, so good. It is, however, another list. Sorry about that. Buddhism has got loads of lists. Jhanas are split into two groups of four because there's eight of them. The first four I see as kind of the earthly, earthly jhanas, and their primary focus is samadhi, which is the gentle, absorbed focus concentration, developing the ability to sit undisturbed by our minds. The second four are what we know as the heavenly, for want of a better word, or perhaps immaterial. As they're sometimes known, in these jhanas, we start to experience what's called vipassana, which is insight and wisdom deep into the heart of the true nature of things. In our experience of the first four, we get flashes early on in our meditation of this wisdom and insight. We really do. Little moments where suddenly a light dawns and you just understand something. But we can't really abide in these states for periods of time, because we've not yet attained those first four. So we're not stable, consistently concentrated. But we do experience these flashes, and they're real educators for us, and they pull us forward on our journey. So as we drive north, we may well come, when we stop at the services, we might come across people with a Scottish accent. But it's not until we arrive in Scotland that we'll hear the accent from most of the people we come across. So when we're new to meditation, we cannot know what these jhanas are like. The Buddha gives the example of trying to explain to someone who's never tasted salt before what salt tastes like. You know, how would you do that? Oh, it's a little bit salty. That doesn't help at all. And the jhanas are just like this. When, you know, until we experience them, we can't really get a grip for what it's going to be like. It's probably different for each of us as well, actually. when we first experience them, it can be a big old shock, actually. So I've experienced the first two jhanic states, and the first jhanic state was a big shock. What did it feel like for me? It was a big physical rush that went through my body. I was just sitting, meditating, and all of a sudden, just a very, very powerful rush went through my body. And it's a real sense of calm that floods the mind. And actually, you just think, I can sit here forever. You know, it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But it has its downsides. Excuse me. When you hit it, excitement cuts in. Oh my God, I'm enlightened. And your meditation, lo and behold, comes crashing down. So you have to go back and work again. And because it's so nice, it's very seductive. So you go searching for it. And of course, the jhanic states, they don't appear when you search for them. Because they do just materialise like those signposts on the road. You can't make those signposts appear quicker. That's not going to get you further on your journey. If we put all the signposts for Scotland in the first 100 yards of Taunton, we're not going to get to Scotland any quicker. So they have to arise at the right time. The first jhana is really important because it actually educates us. It teaches us a great deal and shows us how to work with the subsequent ones. So the jhanas, they can be seen as kind of pairing with the hindrances. And it helps us to battle these hindrances on a longer term basis. And the first jhana, it really pairs well with the hindrance of sensual desire. In order to enter the jhana, we must have a mind that isn't constantly distracted by sensual pleasure. So that ranges from desiring pleasant tastes, smells, food, pretty objects that are pleasing to the eye and kind of feed our natural craving, through to full-blown lust. And with our exploration of the Eightfold Path, we've already learnt to develop a degree of acceptance to our life. We've learnt an approach to deal with not chasing our desire factor all the time. How to deal with that. Nice things are there, and we don't deliberately push away these nice things. As we've talked about, renunciation isn't about not having these things, not having nice food, etc. Renunciation is understanding our emotional reaction to those things and seeing desire as it arises in the mind and being able to let that go. When we let that go, we experience a wonderful state of bliss. And it's interesting because there we are, just sitting on a cushion. There's no money involved, there's no food involved, there's nothing particular, there's not a nice car, shiny, nice colour. There's just you on a cushion, and you experience this amazing state of bliss. Pure contentment. And actually that's what teaches us and takes us forward for the next three of the earthly jhanas. That experience starts to help us to understand the hindrances and how they keep us back from the jhanas and stop us from passing the milestones. And once we've mastered the first jhana, we should practice with it as often as we can to get used to it, to nurture it. So we keep going back there. It's a bit of an odd journey, this, because...
Does it come back in the same form each time?
You tend to develop your own mental tricks, if you like, for getting into it. And for each of us, that will be individual. Some of us will use visualizations. For me, personally, a very powerful way for me to enter into the first jhana, when I'm sitting in meditation and concentrate on the breath, although my eyes are closed, I look. And I just look into as far as I can see. And it kind of creates this feeling of floating forward. The first time I experienced it, I didn't quite make it in because actually fear arose. Because for me, what's associated with this is this feeling of huge expansion. And you know, if you go into a cave and it's pitch black, but the cave widens out into a cavern, you can feel the space, even though you can't see anything. You get this sense of, whoa, there's something big in front of me. There's a big space. And that's what my experience of entering that first jhana was like. And I actually, the first time I started to feel that, I backed away because I got a real sense of fear. And I had to work with that and work with that and eventually just float out into that space. And that's when it's just, lovely feeling of bliss occurred. Now, your experience of jhana will not be like that. It'll be different. But because of your experience, you'll discover your own route, if you like, your favourite route up to that first milestone, you know. Whenever we go to Bridgewater, we generally have our favourite route that avoids the traffic or whatever. And this is very much like that. So it is personal, if that makes sense.
How do you know it's the first jhanic state? Did the Buddha describe each of them?
Well, he gave us a flavour of their nature, and he did describe this huge feeling of bliss that you get.
With each one, or just the first?
No, that's the first. The nature of the first is this rush of bliss. So the first jhana has its limits, and at this time we've now got a sustained application. We can concentrate our mind, but it still feels rather coarse. The other hindrances are very much there, and we discover that to stay there does require quite hard discipline and effort, and it feels quite hard. It's nice, but you still have to apply the effort. The second jhana we slip into, and slip into is a good way to describe it because it does feel like that. It feels, entry into the second jhana for me felt like an accident. So you've been trying and trying and trying, and in many ways you just, you kind of, I mean, Pema Chodron describes in one of her books, she says, give up hope. Which sounds awful, doesn't it? Which sounds rather pessimistic, but what she means by that is when we have hope, it's kind of desire, you know. So we're desiring, we're pushing for that second jhana, and then you suddenly think, this is getting me nowhere. Oh, just meditate and... there we go.
And are you still in the first jhana while you're meditating?
Yeah.
To reach the second.
Yeah, they're building blocks.
Yeah. So you wouldn't want to get out in the first one if it's a straight.
That's the trouble. That's the catch-all. And you have to kind of accept it. And it is about accepting it. You know, one of the latter states is equanimity, which is actually an appreciation of all aspects of our lives. Already this first jhana is teaching us about this, because it's teaching us not to get dependent on desiring and on blissful things. Actually, if we're going to progress, we've got to let go of this and crack on. You know, Birmingham's a lovely place, but if we're going to get to Scotland, we're going to leave it there. So the second jhana, it's often described as rapture. Now, when I started reading about this, I really couldn't get my mind around what that meant. And actually, that word didn't help me find it. It felt, well, too generic for me. My experience of the second jhana is just a feeling of calm, confidence. That's what it felt like for me. And actually, relief. There was a feeling of relief. Because I had hooked into that first blissful feeling for some time. A real sort of heady feeling, if you like. But that just kind of settled. And I just felt grounded and calm, peaceful. So that was the feeling for the second jhana for me. As far as I'm concerned, that's as far as I've got. So I've got a long way to go yet. So what we're going to look at now are the places further north on the journey. Head beyond, perhaps into the Lake District. See what the Buddha taught us about the next states. The third jhana is where some aspect of the deep unification of the mind starts to kick in. So we get the calm comprehension, single-pointed concentration, and those two start to combine. And I often talk in my talks here about the mental habit in our lives that we've established. And what goes on with the third jhana is a real ability to start to break down that mental habit, to allow the unification of the conscious with the subconscious. We start to let go of that mental habit that binds us. And because of that, our concentration gets heightened still further. In many ways, in the first two jhanas, we can feel how our mental habit gets in the way. And, you know, that's why we have to keep battering at it to get there. In the third jhana, that mental habit starts to subside. And actually, this really does affect us in our life as well as in meditation. It starts to affect us deeply. If you think of those five hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, worry and doubt, they'll still be there in the background, but we now see and really experience those mental ruts in our own minds that draw us into them. And those ruts start to level out. We understand how they disrupt our equanimity, why we can't appreciate all aspects of our lives. We start to see how we're pushing one aspect away and going towards another aspect. So our whole life becomes much bigger, much richer. The fourth jhana, this is where a real sort of fundamental change happens, and I really don't have a great grip on what this must feel like. You know, there's been times where in a third jhana I can appreciate equanimity. Fourth jhana, it's just an academic level, really. But here, and it's quite a meaty subject, we let go of the concept of self. And when we let go of that, we let go of the cause of suffering. Simple as that. So It's quite meaty on this one. So, yes, I can understand it at an academic level, but I've no idea what it must actually feel like.
You carry that into
your daily life. All four of these jhanas you carry into your daily life.
So you have glimpses of more.
Yeah. If you think about the first jhana, so you've experienced this huge bliss sitting on the cushion. So then, when you're in your daily job and you're stressed out and the boss is shouting at you, it just gives you a feeling of confidence that actually there's more to life than this. And you can just accept it and crack on. So all four jhanas, you know, they affect you. But I think the fourth, this is fundamental change. And it will, you know, make no mistake, with Buddhist practice, if you go into Buddhist practice, expect change. You are going to change as a person. And, you know, I think people have to take responsibility for that. If you're going to change to that extent, it may well affect your relationships with your family, your friends, because you will become a different person. And here, you know, the very person that we are, we're letting go of. That's what's happening in the fourth state. So who can really predict actually what effect that's going to have on us and our lives?
It will be for the good rather than the bad, won't
it? I believe so, yes. I believe so. It all sounds rather nihilistic, doesn't it? You know, letting go of self. What am I? Who am I? Think of it this way. You know, one of the big fears we have in life is death. And of course, death is the implication of that loss of a self, ultimately. Well, here, what we're saying is actually, the concept of a self is just a concept. It's a human thing artificially created by the nature of the mind. We're letting go of that. So actually, Andy Spragg will never die because Andy Spragg was never born in the first place. And it's that kind of feeling that you reach in the fourth state. So it's a true liberation from the base suffering of a human being. You know?
I've never known anybody come back worse off.
No. No, that's right. Yeah. You
know, like Buddhist monks and nuns who I've met who really were on the journey a lot, long way, are people who really offer something back in a very positive way.
Mm. And,
help with the master.
Mm. I'm not sure the practice would have sustained for 2,500 years if it gave bad results. It's an interesting one, this, and I think the fourth jhanic state requires great self-honesty. In the Buddhist community, you get people who describe themselves as free-spirited. They travel widely, they dress in a certain way, but all of that is ego. They're holding on to that aspect of themselves. They build this free-spirited image. I'm a free spirit. It's ego. It's a badge itself. And there's pride and there's purpose and all that stuff there that represents a sense of self. So we're going way beyond that in the fourth jhanic state. So that's the base four, the earthly. There's another four. Oh, my word. To be honest, I'm not going to dwell much on these. They're such a long way away for me. I can't speak much about them. But it is in those four that the real insight and wisdom develop. The first four encourage us to understand that feeling of boundless space. When we get into the second four, you know, we even go beyond that. So the appreciation of space, that's just a human concept. So we go beyond that. I cannot imagine what that feels like. So we're going to take the first step today. Right concentration with our mind, our meditation. We started this, we're going to use the same meditation as last week. Mindfulness of breathing. And we're really going to go into the breath and look at the edge spot between the in-breath and the out-breath and use that as our focus and let everything else go and just settle into that. That's what we've got to concentrate on. Right, concentration. I'll talk you through the body scan. Those that are new, we'll do the body scan first, and then we'll come to the breath wherever you feel it in the body, and we'll use the word still. So on each out breath, hear the word still echo in the mind. Use that to really let the body settle. When we're sitting, we get thousands of little micro movements. Let the word still really settle those and drop into the breath. And then we'll let go of the word and just go into the breath and look at that space between the in-breath and the out-breath and explore that, that tiny little moment. Okay? So closing our eyes, settling down. Just relaxing down. Tune into the space around you first. Have your gaze slightly downcast, as if you're looking below the horizon. Just establish a nice relaxed posture, but with a sense of strength in the spine to bring purpose into the mind. To stay with the practice. We'll start with our little Buddhist mantra. If you wish to join in, please do. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Nama, Am Hung. We'll start with the body scan. Take your minds into your feet. Feel all the sensations there, both inside and out on the surface, just exploring those tiny little sparks of sensation. Perhaps temperature, contact with the ground. Even here, the mind will be pulled away. When you notice that, just bring it gently back to the body, wherever you've got to. Working across the soles of the feet, up over the heels, and working up through the ankle bones. Up into the shins and the calf muscles. And as you travel, any tension, any holding, try to let go. Up into the knees, feeling as much as you can. And as you travel, any pain you experience in the body, Notice your reaction to it. Notice perhaps how you push it away, how tension forms around it. Instead, try to offer a sense of friendship towards that area, a sense of letting go. Work up on the thighs and the hamstrings, feeling the muscles and up into the sitting bones, sinking into the seat. As we sink and settle, we allow the head to float up a little. And feel the spine stretching out. Take the awareness into the stomach and the heart area. And here we find the physical result of our emotions. So don't look at the stories behind them. Just look at the nature of the physical emotion. How do you feel? Come up to the shoulders. Any tension there, let it melt out. And take your awareness down your arms and into the hands and the fingers. Back up to the head. Notice what you can feel across the scalp. Any tiny little sensations. And then come into the face, relaxing the muscles around the eyes. Jaw unclenched, letting go of the frown. A gentle smile of compassion on the lips. Bring all of these sensations together. Thousands of sensations in the body, plus your emotions, sitting in this space with friends. Our life in this moment, right now. We celebrate each moment with a breath. Bring your awareness to the breath, the physical sensation of it, wherever it's most obvious to you. And as you gently breathe, on each out-breath, let the word still echo in the mind and settle in the body. Let go of thoughts, just let them flow out of the mind. Focus on the breath. Still. just the breath, still. Let go of the word and draw in closer to the breath. Examining all stages of the breath, but in particular, the boundary between the in-breath and the out-breath. Is there really a boundary there? What's the nature of that space? Take a look. just the breath. Nothing else matters. Gently bring your awareness back into the room. Feel the space around you. Feel your body sitting in this space, and the presence of friends sitting with you. Just enjoying the calm, tranquil feeling. Offer yourself a silent resolution to take this sense of peace and mindfulness out into the day. Like ripples in a pond, we make a difference. Om Mani Padme Hum. When you're ready, open your eyes and bring your meditation to an end.